and welcome to another edition of Armchair Directors. For each episode, we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the 2014 film Still Alice, directed by Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland. Returning on the show today to talk about Still Alice, Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back.
So, yeah, this is basically, in my opinion, Julianne Moore's movie. Like, when we're talking about armchair directors, I can't really say much about the directors because this is an entirely performance-driven movie, and it's pretty much all eyes on Julianne Moore. This is the big performance piece. This is all about you got to show your, you know, you got to show a wide range of emotions. You're struggling with a disease. It's like an actor actress's heaven.
It is. It's such a juicy role, and there's not really, I don't know if you've realized this, but there are not usually a lot of great roles for women of a certain age. You know, once you get past the ingenue, then you're, you know, the horrible stepmother or the mother-in-law. Yeah, the crone. So anybody would have loved to do this role. And they actually offered it to Michelle Pfeiffer, Julia Roberts, Diane Lane, and Nicole Kidman first. And of the, I think they all could have done the role, mm-hmm. but I think Nicole Kidman, of the those four women, would have been the best if it wasn't Julianne Moore.
Yeah, but looking at this film, it is sort of hard to imagine anyone else than Julianne Moore doing it. So I think she really nails the performance in this movie once again, where almost the hopelessness she feels when she has trouble even remembering going to the bathroom.
Mm-hmm. And, where is it?
She wets herself, and you know, just the crying and everything. It's a really good performance and really empathetic.
It is. She is absolutely fantastic in the role. Now, she suggested the role of the husband to Alec Baldwin because they wanted to work together again.
What were they in?
Oh, Third Rock. I think they had a...
The TV show?
Yeah, the TV show. Season 4 of 30 Rock, I'm sorry.
Oh, 30 Rock.
30 Rock. Yeah, they play romantic partners in that. Now, they show in the movie that Alice is a compulsive Words with Friends player. That's a little joke because Alec Baldwin was notoriously booted off of a plane before takeoff in 2011 because he refused to stop playing the game and power down his phone. So that's a little joke in there. So they wanted to work together, and I think they're very believable.
Yeah,
and you can also see his side, that he's watching a train wreck happen that he can't prevent, and it's agonizing. And he has mm-hmm. some great moments because I like Alec Baldwin, but I don't think he's a great actor. Mm-hmm. But I thought one of the high points emotionally was when the disease has progressed and, you know, they're going out to get ice cream. And he says to her, trying to like level with her, like talk to her about real things, and says, "Do you want to be here?" Meaning, do you want to be here on Earth anymore? And she mm-hmm. thinks he's talking about the ice cream cone. Why? Do we have to leave? And then he realizes, oh, that conversation, it's too late for that conversation. Yeah. We're not going to be able to have that conversation. She doesn't understand what he means. And it's excruciating.
And that was after she tried to commit suicide, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And I guess reading about it, she really did the method acting for this movie as far as preparation. She interviewed a lot of people who are suffering from early onset Alzheimer's. She even studied it in like a special nursing home for people who are suffering from Alzheimer's. So she really, like, not only performed a good, great role, but she really studied the hell out of this movie.
Yeah, she also took that memory test that they have and passed it.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I could do that memory test because it is just because, like, they tell you to remember this name, remember this address, and then they kind of distract you with all these, you know, extra little side things. They go, oh, by the way, can you tell me that name? And you're like, what was it again?
Yeah, what was it again? Was it Washington or was it Jefferson? Yeah. It's tricky because you think, oh, I'll remember that. The other thing to know about the movie is that the co-director, Richard Glatzer, had ALS and couldn't speak. So he directed the film using a text-to-speech app on his iPad, and both Moore and Stewart dedicated their ice bucket challenge to him.
Yes, and I believe Glatzer died shortly after this movie was made, right?
Right. He wasn't able to go to the Oscars to see Julianne Moore. By the way, she was the only nomination for this film.
Yeah, Best Actress. Yeah. And another thing I did like about the movie, like you talk with Alec Baldwin, there's no, like, I say the added extra drama. You know, there's no, like, with the family members, they don't, like, blow up at her and leave her. I mean, like Baldwin has this chance to go to the Mayo Clinic, and you don't really know if he's going to take it or not. There's never like a point where like they blow up at her, like where they like one scene when they get upset because she looks at her diary, the daughter, but. They never, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's never turns too soap opera-ish. And that's one thing I appreciate. It's mainly about dealing with this disease, and there's no added extra drama.
Yeah, it wasn't over the top. And but you also see, you know, that's a real problem when you're the, you know you're going to be the surviving spouse. You have to plan for after. You can't just indulge every whim. You have to make tough decisions, like whether or not you're going to accept that job. Mm-hmm. And there's another devastating scene where they're talking about the job, he and his kids, and she's sitting in a chair like right there while they're talking about her in the third person. Well, what are we going to do about mom? Well, dad, I don't really think you should take that job. I don't think you should move. And then they're all having this whole conversation around her, and you don't even know if she can tell that the conversation is happening.
We see her, and she's just kind of staring off into the distance, and in the background, they're talking. You can see it, but they're blurred. They're out of focus. So and then she kind of asks some innocuous question like, you know, this room is too big or something. And then it focuses in on them. Yeah. Great. Good. Great scene.
Yeah. It's based on a book, which is fiction, but it reads like a true story. And it goes a lot more into her confusion. You know, you're sort of trapped in her head with her in the book. You know, you can hear what she's thinking, like she can't find the word. Or she's pretending to go along with what people are saying because she reads the cues, but she doesn't really understand what they're saying. And a lot more of that comes out in the book, which is, you know, very powerful. But I think Julianne Moore owns that role. You know, she makes you believe that this woman is actually losing her words. And what do you do? What do you do if that's your lifeblood? She's a linguistics person. What do you do when you lose yourself?
Yeah, you were talking about how it's based on the novel, based on a novel by Lisa Genova. And I think she's written a series of novels, and they're all kind of where somebody is suffering from illnesses. Like this one's about early onset Alzheimer's. But I know, look, I was doing some research, and she has had a whole book series about here's this person, here's something they're suffering from. And it's not just like, and some people might think that's like exploitation or something, but I think what she's really trying to do is sort of raise awareness about these issues and, you know, get people, because when you think about Alzheimer's, you think of people more like in their 70s and 80s, like Julianne Moore is getting this and she's just turned 50.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of the things that comes out better in the book, and I don't think they put this in the movie at all. She says to the social worker that's assigned to, you know, help you with your emotional issues, with your illness. She says, well, where's the support group for people like me? Because all she can find is support groups for people like her husband, person dealing with the caretaker, but nothing for people who have it. And they say, well, you know, they're most of the time they're in their 80s and 90s, and there's, you know, no activities you can really plan. Plus, you never know when they're really present. So it's almost impossible. So she does it on her own. And she finds people who are also have early onset, and they talk about what they've lost. And so she has a feeling of, I'm not alone. I have other people to talk to. But that falls apart pretty fast because they've all got early onset Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's the thing with this movie. It's, you know how sometimes in TV shows, you know, they have the very special episodes where it's like, it's all about like this certain topic. And like even you kind of still even see that now. Like, have you seen the HBO series Sharp Objects with Amy Adams?
I read the book.
Yeah, which is a great series, and so you probably know what happens anyway. But at the very end of each episode, they kind of say, if you or someone you know is suffering from, you know, like has self harm problems, please contact this number. And it's even sponsored by Sharp Objects and everything. So like even that, like, because one of the characters harms herself in that book, so that's sort of bringing awareness to that. In this movie, it's kind of the same thing. Like, it's bringing awareness to the early onset Alzheimer's. I believe some of the funding, or maybe entirely the funding, was this movie went to fund early onset Alzheimer's charities or causes.
I didn't know that, but I wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. They filmed this in 23 days, by the way.
That kind of makes sense.
I mean, it's all out of order, too.
Yeah, it's very, like, I'm not saying it's quick or cheap or anything, but there's not a lot of settings. I mean, there's pretty much their houses. Maybe that vacation house, and then the place where she goes to make the speeches.
And the outside scenes around Columbia University, I guess. Although in the book she's at Harvard, but the point is, she used to be very, very smart.
Yeah. So, yeah, but it's I can imagine how, not saying it's cheap or anything, but you don't have, there's not like a lot of elaborate sets and things you need to build to get this made, get this movie done.
What I think is impressive, though, is that she was working on The Hunger Games and took a month off, went over, made this movie, came back, finished Hunger Games. But that 23 days was this tour de force performance and not anything at all like her character in The Hunger Games.
Yeah, I forget. She was like the evil boss or something in The Hunger
Games. She has a, you know, like an administrative kind of evil ruler kind of a role.
Yeah, just like that whole movie, all that, those movies, I remember Grown Ups Evil, Teenagers Good. Like, that's all I kind of remember.
Now, she won what they call, Julianne Moore won what they call the quintuple crown of Best Actress for this. She won the Golden Globe, the Screen Actors Guild, the Critics' Choice, the BAFTA, and the Academy Awards. And that's mm-hmm. only the second time that someone did that. The first one was Cate Blanchett, who won all of those things for her role in Blue Jasmine.
Which was just a year before. Wow, that happens 2 years in a row. And it's like I said, this is a performance-driven movie. And like I might talk earlier in the show, like Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland are the directors. And I think the directing work they probably do is mostly with the performances, because as far as everything else, there's not really that much to do. It's more just, let's just focus framing. On her, frame it, shoot it, edit to the next scene, We're good. It's not much like directing work outside of getting performances.
You know, I don't know if it was a cynical choice to pick this movie, but this role is the fifth consecutive character with a mental illness to win an Oscar for Best Actress.
And that sort of gets into one of the things I say. Do you think this is an Oscar bait film? Now, a lot of people have different definitions of Oscar bait films. One, people say it has it tackles some sort of social issue, whether it's homosexuality or racism or some important social issue that everybody can pat themselves on the back and feel better about because they watched it. Or it could be a movie about how great the movie era is, something like The Artist or La La Land or even Birdman, because that's all about an artist. Or sometimes it could just be like this biographical period piece, like, Darkest Hour or Imitation Game.
Barry Lyndon.
Yeah. Something preferably about British people in World War II. So, you have this, but you also have, like you said, this could be an Oscar bait film because it's all about a performance movie about somebody with a disability. You got this, and even the same year, Eddie Redmayne won for playing Stephen Hawking.
Right.
Think about Daniel Day-Lewis and My Left mm-hmm. Foot. There's 100 different performances where you're playing a disability. And it's kind of one of those Oscar bait films where it's mainly made to give an actor or an actress an award because you're playing this tough role. Because you play it so well, you'll get an Oscar for it almost.
Although one difference is that Eddie Redmayne and Daniel Day-Lewis did those roles in their prime as young men. And there's lots of roles for men in their prime, young mm-hmm. men. And there's not a lot of roles like Julianne Moore plays here.
Good point.
So I think that's also one of the other reasons, because sometimes don't you feel like they pick winners for the Oscars because it's somebody's turn or...
Definitely.
They've just decided, it's time for Julianne Moore to win. And sometimes it's not for that performance. It's for something else where they were gypped.
Yeah. And that's kind of what I remember we talked about last week where I was like, this kind of almost feels like, not that the performance is bad, that by no means bad in this movie, not like completely.
Is she ever bad? Yeah. She's never bad.
Yeah. But it's almost like, well, she's done all these great things, but we've never given an Oscar for it. Here, she's playing this movie about somebody with a disability. Let's give her an Oscar. She's probably good in that, And it's like even, how have we not given Gary Oldman an Oscar this year? He's playing Winston Churchill. He had, a British mm-hmm. guy during World War II. He had to put a bunch of makeup on.
Serious movie.
Give him that Oscar.
Yeah, that's got to be him.
We hadn't given Paul Newman an award yet. Oh, he did a movie with Martin Scorsese. Oscar. On and on and on. Roger Deakins, no cinematography award. Oscar. It's kind of, they always kind of do that where it's like, it's your turn. Leonardo DiCaprio, like they do it all the time.
Or, they completely forget, your entire career. And then they have to, trot out the old
Lifetime Achievement
award. Yeah. Yeah.
Not even get me started on Morricone. Like, for years, they never gave him an Oscar. They give him a Lifetime Achievement Award when he's 80. And then he does the great The Hateful Eight in 2015. Like, okay, now we have to give him a real Oscar, even though he was 87 when he finally won his first.
But anyway. Now, another fun inside joke is that Julianne Moore was in Crazy Stupid Love. And in that movie, she remarks that she saw the latest Twilight film and that it was so bad.
And yeah, you were... I guess we talked that can perfectly lead into the other performances in the film. And I thought Kristen Stewart was decent. I mean, I didn't... She kind of does that Kristen Stewart thing where she's like... You know, she kind of always has that laugh, like, oh, that's ridiculous. That kind of gets a little bit grating. But she was good, and Baldwin, I think, does a good performance. Like I said, he's very sympathetic. In some cheesier movies, he might turn, like evil or something, mm-hmm. or manipulate her, or he'll just ditch her in her time of need. But he actually stays through her. But it's never like he's completely saint, like, I wouldn't say saint-like, but, like, you know, He has moments where he's become frustrated like anybody would, where it's just like, oh, God.
How many times do I have to repeat myself?
Yeah.
Yes, I'm coming back on Saturday. Yeah. Yeah, you feel for him. Mm-hmm. You feel for him, and you feel for how he's trying very hard to be patient, but that's got to be really hard.
And while you see sort of how it affects Stewart and Baldwin, the third, she was almost like a third wheel, was Kate Bosworth. Mm-hmm. I mean, because sometimes I thought she was going to be like the antagonist, because she gets into fights with Kristen Stewart all the time. She's kind of the one that's a little bit snotty, I would say. And you think there's going to be more to her character, but yeah, she was sort of like the third wheel for me. She didn't really do much.
Well, there's the Kate Bosworth character, the Kristen Stewart character, and then the son.
Oh, yeah. And he was like a fourth wheel. Yeah, how memorable is he? I completely forgot he was the character.
But the point of the three children is to, what do you do with wanting to know? Because it's hereditary, the disease that she has. So the oldest daughter decides to find out and finds out she's got the gene. And then the son does not have it, and...
Kristen Stewart doesn't want to know.
Now, see, this is a terrible thing. This is also one of these things that's like, I think I probably had a reaction to it that you might not have because you're not a mom. But that's one of those things that I think in terms of, you know, there's always so much to feel guilty about as a mother. But to think that you pass this on to your children, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And that your daughter who has it wants desperately to have a baby. So, you know, you've realized you've just... You know, would you have had the children if you had known? And, you know, you're passing it on, like, to future generations as well. It's hard. There's so much heartbreak in the movie. Mm-hmm.
Well, just because they have the gene, that doesn't...
If you have it at 100%.
Oh, 100%.
This is happening to you, yes.
Oh, okay.
Unless they come up with some sort of cure in the meantime. But yeah, it's a death sentence. And you see, not only am I going to have it, I'm going to watch my mother go through it, and this is what's going to happen to me. I thought Kristen Stewart was better than you did.
Yeah.
Because
I don't think she was bad. I mean, especially compared to, like, the Twilight movies. But, like, it's just, she kind of has it.
but she's this sort of self-involved 20-something, that by the end of the movie, she has a bit of a change. She's the one, when you're watching the movie, that she seems to understand what's going on with her mom. You know, they're FaceTiming, and she's like, Mom, where's the person who's supposed to be with you? Why are you alone? But she's also on the other side of the coast, so it's not like she can just pop on over. You know, and by the end of the movie, she's decided she's going to go to school, and she's going to do these things that she was completely against in the beginning. I found her very sympathetic and likable.
Oh, yeah. And I can even think of the scene when she gets upset at her mom for looking at her journal. And then, like, a couple scenes later, she kind of realizes, well, that's such a small issue. There's no point in squabbling about it, especially with her condition.
Which is kind of an adult thing to think.
Yeah. Because, like, as, you know, it's your diary. I mean, any teenager, like, oh, you went through my diary? How could you? But, like, you know, now you're in your 20s, like, I don't care.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. When you think about all the things that are important to get upset about, that's really small potatoes.
So once again, she won an Oscar for this movie, which was the only nomination for this movie. And I was looking, okay, who did she beat out? And I don't remember the others, but the one notable one was Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl. And I thought she should have won for that. I thought I would probably say I enjoyed Rosamund Pike because just That movie always had me guessing, and I thought sheer performance was extremely terrifying. Because I'm not going to spoil the movie, but like you think it's going one way, then it goes the other. And she really is pretty much the center of the movie. And she gives Rosamund Pike's a great actress, but like that's probably her best role.
She was really good in that one with the post-Civil War, returning the Indian to...
Oh, Hostiles. That was a great movie, too.
She was great in that. Yeah. I think she might have won if it hadn't been time to, you know, the fifth consecutive year for mental illness to win. By the way, do you remember the big scandal with Sony Pictures that they were hacked?
And yep.
This was one of the movies that was out before.
And leaked online.
Yeah. So, you know, I think that also might have been another reason why it got a little more attention because... You know, it sort of didn't have a chance.
Yeah. Sony Pictures is like, if you really look at like how they've been doing, I think they're one of the most inept movie studios out there, just not only with that hack, but just everything they've done lately. It's like the movies they come out with are like terrible. Like they're the ones that came out with the Emoji movie. And you look at the other movies that were like, that were pitched to them and they said no to, and are like, really? Like that's not good enough for you, but the effing Emoji movie is? Like they're and like even with that hacking, like and you that was the same time with the whole The Interview controversy, and like really you're gonna let your cave down to a movie to a North Korean dictator, like you should tell them to go stick it, and that's what everyone told them, but they cowed down and like, well, we're gonna pull this from theaters. So yeah, I don't like Sony Pictures.
Well, this was one of the movies that suffered from that hacking.
Which is a shame, because this is a good movie.
By the way, this is the third time Julianne Moore has escaped a drug overdose suicide in a movie. The other times were in The Hours and in Magnolia. So, you know, another reason why she might have won the Oscar and not Rosamund Pike is that both were dramas, but her character was more likable.
Yeah, that's a good point. I still say that her best role for me is Amber Waves in Boogie Nights.
Oh, I did like that movie.
And she, because she's this kind of this queen of like the adult film industry. She does a lot of movies, but she's kind of like sort of like the mother figure to everybody. Like the mother figure to Roller Girl, and she's the mother girl to Dirk Diggler, Mark Wahlberg's character. And while she has like, you know, she's this respected force in the industry, you figure out her character. She's also like drug addicted, and she has a child that she's always trying to see. But you know that because she's a porn star, she's got this drug problem that there's no way in hell she's ever going to see her daughter. There's this one particular scene where she's either throughout this party, she's either screwing somebody or she's doing a lot of coke. And while doing that, somebody's on the phone, and it's her daughter trying to talk to her. And that's just a heartbreaking scene because she's been trying all this time to see her, but, you know, she's out doing, you know, things, adult industry things. So, you know, it's a great
Daniels
performance.
Things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, interestingly enough, this summer I was in Denmark with the Study Abroad group, and we went to this really avant-garde art museum called Arken. And one of the displays that they had was a film that they were showing. And they had filmed Julianne Moore and Alec Baldwin reading these testimonies of people who were escaping looking for political asylum here in the United States. It was these real people stories, but they were playing them as parts. So they had no makeup on Julianne Moore playing this, a couple of characters. And you could tell who was who because her jewelry or her glasses or whatever would change. And same thing with Alec Baldwin. He played a couple of characters talking about escaping strife in their homeland, trying to get into the United States. And it was really powerful. Both of them did amazing work in that. That's one of those things you kind of come across them somewhere. It's like, oh, I know that actor and I like that actor. And then they're able to, you know, capture your interest for longer because you're thinking, wait, what are they doing here? Wait, this is actually three roles. I think both of them have real acting chops.
Yeah, probably the most notable thing I'll ever remember Alec Baldwin from is his puppet role in Team America World Police. It wasn't him, but somebody was voicing him. It was like, Kim Jong-il's like, I've got Eric Baldwin. Like, you are Wartrish, Eric Baldwin. So that's the best thing. I'm going to always remember Eric Baldwin from Team America.
I think my favorite role with him is Boss Baby.
Okay. I think the best role, like performance-wise, seriously though, is and it's such a small role, is Glengarry Glen Ross. Because you know, he's only in it for like one scene, but it just it dominates that whole movie. It sets the tone for that whole movie. I can't even because he curses like half the time, so I can't quote anything from it. But oh, it's perfect, and it's just a small role too. So okay, we've been once again we haven't really touched that much into Richard Glatzer, the directors Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland. I know none of their movies really ring a bell for me. There is one notable movie they did before this, and it was called Last of Robin Hood, and it was about the last days of Errol Flynn. I think he died under some sort of mysterious circumstances, and Kevin Kline plays Errol Flynn, and Errol Flynn was kind of a pervert, but anyway.
Well, that's another story. Actually, one of the reasons why I thought it would be kind of cool to mention the director is because there's a movie coming out about Colette. Yeah, about the French novelist. And Keira Knightley is Colette. So it's going to get a big, you know, it's going to get a lot of press.
And they're directing it? Or
just the one guy.
Yeah, because
his partner died.
Okay.
So that should be also, again, another great role. But Keira Knightley's still pretty young, so she's, you know, she can do anything.
All right. So getting close to my questions here, is there anything we haven't discussed about Still Alice or the directors or the actors that you want to bring up now?
Well, I did want to know how you felt about that fear of losing your words. Because what are you without words? There's a French movie that I watched, the name escapes me at the moment, where it's part of the movie is a cafe conversation between this older philosopher and this young woman. And he says to her, you know, we cannot think without words. All ideas have to be, you know, they have to be named. We need words for things to know things. And I always thought that was mind-blowing to think about that, that without words, we can't think.
Yeah.
I think, so, you know, what do you think about
I guess I can relate to that because working in radio, the biggest fears I have is what if it's the day of a big interview, something like this, and I forgot my script? And would I be able, and like there's in circumstances, whatever, this is the only time I can do it. It's not something that can be rescheduled when I have it and I can't go back to get the script. And the biggest fear is like, will I be able to improv and just come up on the whiff? And what if I don't? Like that's going to really just not be good professionally or anything. And so that's probably my biggest fear. So I can kind of connect to that.
What did you think of the title of the movie, too?
Yeah, because I was like, I forgot to ask about that. I would probably say it's more about, like, she's still, because at the end, she's really not, like, well, I don't know, because, like, she at the end, we see Kristen Stewart reading that passage from Angels in America, and she goes, it's about love. You can see, like there maybe just be the tiniest little bit of Alice left, but you can tell she's almost all gone.
In the book, one of the things that happens at the very end is that her husband is reading the paper about how a promising drug for Alzheimer's fails, and then he cries. Hmm. And that's how they sort of end that story in the book, where you realize all hope, dashed, inexorable decline, very sad, but also just makes you think, oh, my God. You know, how much of you is being able to express yourself? So I thought it was a brilliant movie. Not a lot of movies really take you there.
Mm-hmm.
And this one did.
All right. And then last question I'll have is tell us about the classes you have.
I am teaching Intro to Film, Intro to American Cinema, and Intro to World Cinema. Also this semester I'm doing Film and Philosophy with Dr. Helen Mitchell. And next spring I will do Women in Film with Dr. Teresa Foster.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been discussing the 2014 film Still Alice, directed by Richard Glatzer and Wash Westmoreland. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Tuesday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Tune in to Dragon Digital Radio to hear the show a week before it's on Podbean. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying I'll try to forget that just happened.